From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Flint's mayor says they're ahead of schedule in finding and replacing lead water service lines.
We're not finished. We're not finished, so I don't want anybody to be confused about that. We're not finished.
But the National Resource Defense Council says the city's not going about things the right way. We'll hear why. Plus, a Detroit charter school suddenly closes 3 weeks into the school year.
There are cities across the country that have lots of charter schools like Detroit does, but that take steps to control, you know, the most severe turmoil caused by a free market education system.
And climate change hitting the Great Lakes.
So the surface temperature of the water is increasing. We've seen that in all the lakes in all seasons.
Plus new music from West Michigan. Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello there, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has been nearly 3 years since Flint Mayor Karen Weaver declared a state of emergency because of the water crisis in her city. Today, Mayor Weaver announced the city is way ahead of schedule in its push to find and replace the lead and iron water pipelines. She says contractors have checked more than 18,000 service lines connecting homes to city water mains. Nearly 8,000 of the service lines have been replaced.
We want lead and galvanized pipes out of the city of Flint. We've talked about going from crisis to recovery, and this is another step toward that, and it's a huge step toward that.
But our next guest takes some issue with the way the city is going about replacing these pipes. Dimple Chaudhary is senior attorney with the Natural Resources Defense Council and the organization's lead attorney for the Flint settlement that got the money to fund this water line work. And with us now, Dimple, you sent a letter to the city in September this year outlining concerns about the way the city has gone about replacing the lead pipes there. What are those concerns?
Those concerns are simple. While the city may have dug up many thousands of pipes, and while we agree that that's progress, the city, particularly this past year, has been digging up pipes without targeting the homes that are most likely to have hazardous lead and steel pipes. In short, they've been primarily digging up copper pipes and reburying them. And that is not consistent with their legal obligations under the settlement that we entered into with them that, as you said, provided the money to complete this pipe replacement program.
And how did the city respond to your letter?
The city has not yet fully responded to our letter. We have been in conversations with them about this violation, and we were a little bit surprised and frankly troubled by the characterizations today at the conference suggesting that their legal obligations under the settlement have been met and fulfilled. We are in ongoing conversations, and as the plaintiffs in this case, we will be vigilant in ensuring that the city fully complies with the settlement terms, which, as I said, requires them to find the lead and steel pipes and get those out of the ground, not simply dig holes all around the city.
So today the mayor said the contractors have checked more than 18,000 service lines. 8,000 of those have been replaced. Explain that to us.
So the city has excavated or investigated at 18,000 homes across Flint. That means that they've gone to a home, they've dug a couple of holes to determine what is the composition of the service line at that home. And then if that line is lead or steel, it is replaced. The problem is the city has been not looking in the right areas for those lead and steel lines. So they've only replaced close to 8,000 lines, around 7,700 to be precise. And so the fact that they've dug 18,000 holes or checked 18,000 homes doesn't necessarily mean that they have replaced 18,000 lead lines or that they're even looking for the lead lines in the right places.
As the water crisis unfolded, we all learned that the city's records of lead service lines was pretty woeful. If they existed at all, they were often handwritten on messy index cards, very disorganized. Does the city even have good enough records to accurately prioritize the homes and neighborhoods that should come first?
That is an accurate description of the state of affairs back in 2015 and 16, but a lot of progress has been made on that point. And that's in part due to kind of a groundbreaking model that was prepared by professors at the University of Michigan that would help take the results of the excavations the city has done through this program and predict with greater accuracy where the remaining lead and steel lines are. So there are resources at the city's disposal to do a better job finding the lead and steel lines. Our issue has been that the city hasn't been using them. Certainly this past year, the city hasn't been using this model and other tools available to it in order to better predict where the lead and steel lines are. You know, we think that everywhere does need to be excavated, but our agreement requires there to be a prioritization, and that's for public health purposes. Folks who have lead and steel lines are at the greatest risk, and we need to find those lines first and get them out of the ground.
There's certainly the question of cost. Would it cost more to prioritize the homes in the neighborhoods the way you want them to?
No, it wouldn't cost more. You know, there are ways to prioritize blocks at a time so that you are taking advantage of the efficiencies of going through homes. There are different factors that help predict what areas are likely to have lead and steel lines. And a lot of those factors were incorporated by the University of Michigan into this model that I described. And there are other factors that that have proven throughout the course of this program to be reliable. And so it's not necessarily more expensive to do that. And in fact, it's necessary to protect public health.
So you wrote that letter in September telling the city it's in violation of the settlement agreement. What needs to happen in your view now and why?
The city needs to put a plan in place for 2019 where it prioritizes the removal of lead lines at the homes most likely to have them. It cannot continue to dig holes and excavate, frankly, willy-nilly across the city. It needs to focus on the homes that are likely to have lead and steel lines based on the data that we have. And so, as I said, we are eager to work with the city and work with the state in order to put in place a prioritization plan for excavations in 2019. But if we can't come to an agreement on that, you know, we'll go to the court to enforce this settlement because this is what we fought for and this is what matters.
Dimple Chowdhury is senior attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
The federal government recently released its 2018 National Climate Assessment, the fourth such report. Scientists from 13 federal agencies served up sobering reading. Extreme hot weather more common, cold weather more rare. Extreme weather events are picking up from hurricanes to wildfires. Sea levels are rising, and the report warns that could force tens of millions of people living in coastal areas to move inland. What about the Great Lakes and climate change? Jenna Jorns is one of the writers of the Midwest chapter of this landmark report. Jenna is with the Great Lakes Integrated Sciences and Assessment Center, a joint effort of the University of Michigan and Michigan State University. Jenna, headlines about this report have words like chilling, ominous, devastation. How do you describe what's in it?
I think it is startling to some. The Midwest chapter focuses on risks and adaptation, so I think it's a lot more tangible to be able to relate to impacts happening in their own region. So it can and hopefully serves as a wake-up call to a lot of people in the region.
So let's talk about the Great Lakes because we forget, those of us who aren't scientists, of all the ways that Mother Nature works with the Great Lakes to create our weather and how climate is affected.
Yet the Great Lakes influence our weather and climate every day. They moderate the maximum and minimum temperatures throughout all the seasons, and they influence the cloud cover and precipitation that we get in all seasons as well.
So let's talk about the major ways the Great Lakes are changing, that what's in this report in response to climate change. What's happening to the surface temperature?
So the surface temperature of the water is increasing. We've seen that in all the lakes in all seasons.
All right, so that's going up. What about ice cover?
So ice cover on the Great Lakes is declining.
It's going down. How about lake levels, summer evaporation?
So lake levels are more uncertain. They fluctuate naturally, and the research shows more likely than not that they will decrease a little bit in the future, but the projections are much more uncertain there.
So what are some other ways that we're seeing climate change affect the Great Lakes?
So we're seeing changes in the way that the lake water circulates, the way that the surface and deep water mixes, which is important for exchanging oxygen and nutrients that support our food webs.
Yeah, now this is called destratification.
Yes.
And I think, I dare say, most people aren't familiar with what that is. So explain to us in simple terms, what is destratification? What happens?
So in lakes, the same as in oceans, the surface water is much warmer and the deep water is much colder. And throughout the course of a year, as temperatures change, the temperatures of those two different layers change. So naturally, those two layers mix in the spring and in the fall. The surface waters bring oxygen down to the deep, and then the nutrient-rich deep waters come back up to the surface. So as climate change warms the surface layer, it changes the frequency and the rate that those two layers mix. We're seeing that that mixing is happening sooner, earlier in the year, and the projections show the mixing in the fall may actually not happen even at all, and we have seen that in Lake Superior.
I've got to imagine this is very important for the health of animals, of the fish,
sure,
and the plant life.
Nutrients and oxygen feed up the food web from the bottom up. That affects how algae grow, and that affects how fish grow.
How are we seeing the makeup of species in the Great Lakes changing? How have we seen it change as the climate is changing? And what might we see?
So the ecosystems are very complex, which is not a surprise. So they're affected by mainly the increase in temperatures in the surface waters. Now, for some fish species that could meet increased growth rates, fish are able to thermoregulate, which means they can move vertically within a lake to the temperature where they're most productive, which could be positive for native fish, but that also has the same effect on invasive species.
The ones we do not want in the Great Lakes.
Exactly. So how that same climate impact could affect native and invasive species, we don't yet know.
So that's to be determined. And if we're thinking out ahead, how far out are we looking as far as when we're really going to feel the brunt? Or we're already there?
So we are already seeing changes in the lakes. I think that much is made very obvious in the Midwest chapter. And the climate projections look out to between 50 and 100 years. One thing that we can do is to use climate science to plan for the future. And to do that, we rely on global climate models. We already talked about how the lakes are very important for regional weather and climate. Mm-hmm. But in global climate models, the lakes themselves are often missing or not represented well. So there's a gap between the local climate projections that we need and the credibility of global climate models in the region. So there's a group of regional climate modeling experts led by a team at the University of Michigan that's working on that exact problem, trying to evaluate and analyze global climate models for their appropriateness in the region to provide guidance specifically for decision makers to use the best possible information in our decisions.
Jenna Jorns is with the University of Michigan School for Environment and Sustainability and also the Great Lakes Integrated Sciences and Assessments Center. She was a part of writing the Midwest chapter in the 2018 National Climate Assessment. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up, just 3 weeks into the school year, a Detroit charter school shut down, leaving students and parents in the lurch.
This school is a very harsh reality check for the city about the way our current system is working.
Chalkbeat Detroit reporter Kobe Levin on how state education policies and lax oversight set this school up for failure. Stay tuned. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time to talk music from West Michigan because John Sankovich is back with us. He's the editor and publisher of Local Spins. And John, you've chosen three bands to play for us, all different and all fantastic.
Yes, happy holidays to everyone out there. And I always think it's great at the end of the year to sort of get eclectic because we can show off what's happening in Michigan's music scene, maybe give some folks some ideas for holiday gift giving with Michigan-centric music. And the first one happens to be a band that's a brand new band, but it's a veteran singer and musician who's been around for a while and has really gotten attention. I'm talking about the band Dalmatian Stone, and the singer is Diego Morales. He's a Holland singer and songwriter. He's probably best known by most folks around here as the lead vocalist, a charismatic guy playing with the Soul Syndicate, which is this vintage horn-infused R&B ensemble that's developed a pretty big following in this region. And he's also the lead vocalist for the JMM Jazz Group, where he churns out, you know, jazz vocal standards and Frank Sinatra tunes and Rat Pack classics. And for this particular project, he sort of mixes a lot of that together.
So let's take a listen to this new band from Diego Morales. Let's listen to Dalmatian Stone, and this is I've Got This.
What to do? Then because I like to rock, I don't like to roll. me space and I'll show you what I know. I got this. I can move with you all night long. Feel the beat inside of me. I can do no wrong. I got this. Come and move with me all night long. Dance with me now, baby. I'll show you how I work this song.
This is great, great stuff. Tell us, Morales calls this sound mystophonic. What does that mean?
So I think from his perspective, he's looking at things that are influenced by everything from Prince, Lenny Kravitz, Seal, Nile Rodgers, Jamiroquai, Heatwave. It's a lot of funk, pop, acid jazz, and rock. I think part of it is it's got a sort of an interesting, mysterious feel to it, and at the same time, it's very engaging. And he's also brought together some very talented players for this new band. Bassist Earl Tolliver, drummer Tom Taylor, guitarist Mike Dodge, and a lot of others who are familiar to audiences around here, but who really sort of pump things up, I think, for this. And, you know, Diego's also got a very interesting backstory.
Yeah, tell us about this backstory. I love his voice, but I'm really interested in how he came to be in West Michigan.
So he's of Cuban descent. He grew up in the Chicago area listening to Spanish and English music that his parents loved, you know, things like Nat King Cole and Frank Sinatra and Elvis, and then subsequently a lot of Motown music and things like The Temptations. Eventually he moved, the escaped the gang culture scene in Chicago, moved to Holland while he was in high school. He was eventually recruited into a cover band about 19 years ago, and he's been involved in numerous projects ever since. And you're right, he's got a great voice, and he's got a wonderful stage presence to go along with it.
And when and where can people see Dalmatian Stone?
So the band will host its album release show on December 14th at Billy's Lounge in Grand Rapids.
Well, I'd love to see them get over to Southeast Michigan. I'd definitely check them out. Okay, now, everybody, we get to go back to the future. We're going to start by taking a listen to this song. I'm not going to tell you who this is, but see if you can tell where and when this music is rooted. Okay, that sound takes me straight back to 1964. John, who are we listening to?
This is the Jet Beats. They may be the consummate vintage 60s rock pop band. They've got the sound of the Beatles, of course, and the Mersey beat of the Liverpool era of the early 1960s. They sound like it. They look like it. Band leader Morgan Millemian can't help but write songs. He's actually told me that, you know, everything he writes still sounds like it's 1964, and they really sort of live the whole role of that era.
And this new recording is right in step with that British Invasion Mercy Beat sound. It's analog, isn't it?
It is indeed. It was recorded at the Analog Studio Goon Lagoon here in Grand Rapids. Their latest recording is called High Time. The song we played was I Follow You. And it really does sort of generate that whole vibe of being back in the Cavern Club, where, by the way, this band performed about a year ago. They went over to Liverpool and played a lot of these places where the Beatles became popular back in the day.
This oozes retro sound, John, but it's still new and fresh, so they're not stopping at being a British Invasion tribute band.
No, they do their own thing. They will cover some of the bands and songs from that era, but they definitely have a lot of their original material since this is their third album. They've just hosted their album release show in Grand Rapids. They will once again play Rocky's Bar and Grill in Grand Rapids on December 13th, and I know they're going to be booking a lot of dates in 2019.
All right, well, we're definitely going to keep an ear out and an eye out for the Jet Beats. Next up, Roosevelt Diggs. Tell us a little more about this band before we take a listen.
So a couple of the brothers, Logan and Levi Duddle, started this band many years ago, added bassist John Shears. Eventually, they added the drummer John Ellsworth. It's been a while since they've released an album. This is their third album. It's been a long time coming. Their previous release came out in 2014, but it's clear that they've spent a lot of that time honing their songwriting. Their arrangements are stronger. It's wonderful to listen to this stuff because it's not only kind of an Americana flavor, it's got everything from that country-hued, bluegrass-sounding stuff to this roots rock with growling electric guitars. It's a package that I think really sort of shows off some of their influences from Wilco to the Drive-By Truckers and more.
Let's take a listen to I Only Have Myself to Blame from Roosevelt Diggs.
Don't
Like most about this band? You've got high praise for their new album, Better Days. You say they're one of West Michigan's most compelling releases of 2018. Why is that?
I think they're very rootsy in terms of their approach, but their songwriting has gotten very insightful over the last few years. There's these moments of really tender stuff, and as well as insights into life's hard lessons. I think that really they generate a lot of enthusiasm for their music just by their performances as well as by their music. They're going to be performing, by the way, this Saturday, December 8th at Old Dog Tavern in Kalamazoo.
All right. Well, a great eclectic collection of West Michigan bands from Local Spin's editor and publisher John Sinkovich for our last conversation of 2018. And I know there'll be a lot of great acts to explore looking ahead into the new year. John, thanks so much.
Yeah, definitely looking forward to 2019. Happy New Year to everyone.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. It was Wednesday, September 26th. Students had returned to Detroit's Delta Preparatory Academy for Social Justice just 3 weeks earlier, the homecoming football game just 2 days away. But the team would never take the field. That morning, the Charter Schools Board announced it was shutting down Delta Prep effective immediately. Kobe Levin of Chalkbeat Detroit is here with us now. His latest article is, "If We Don't Learn From This One, Shame on Us. Lessons from a Detroit Charter School That Was Set Up to Fail." Kobe, take us back to that week in September. How do families find out?
So the night before, some families got word that there was going to be a meeting the next day. It was a board meeting with a single item on the agenda, and that's the closure of the school. The next morning, that Wednesday morning, the parents who had gotten that notice and all of the students and all of the teachers piled into the auditorium and asked why. This came as a surprise to them. And after a couple of hours of emotional debate, you know, students saying they didn't want to leave their school, teachers, you know, expressing shock at the suddenness of the whole thing, the board nonetheless voted to close the school. And that was that.
And what was the reaction, especially I'm thinking of these students?
So a lot of the seniors had been at the school since freshman year. Their homecoming dance was that weekend. For a lot of them, this was not about school policy. It was not about, you know, the financial realities and the academic realities that led the school to close. They were just upset to have to leave their friends and to have their school year interrupted in this way.
And there are no rules, no laws that prevent something like this where students get left high and dry 3 weeks after school starts.
A school can close anytime in Michigan. There are some other places in the country where this would have been something like a 6-month process with community deliberation, with a plan put in place in advance for where students would go, but not here.
Kobe Levin, let's rewind and talk about Delta Prep's start. It opened in 2014. Who was behind creating this school and why did they open it?
So you have to start with Edith Friley. She is a longtime educator in Detroit. She had been a teacher. She was a product of the district herself. And she had watched the district go through a really hard time in the first decade and a half of the 2000s. You know, the district was under emergency control. It was headed towards bankruptcy. The whole thing just was very troubling to her. And so she got to talking with her sorority sisters at Delta Sigma Theta, which is the nation's largest sorority of Black professional women. And they agreed that they would help open a school. They would give the sorority's name to a new charter school. They had some trouble getting started at first. Their application was actually rejected once. But then they got in touch with Lou Glazer. He runs a think tank called Michigan Future Incorporated. And at the time, he was steering millions of dollars that had been donated by big-name Michigan philanthropies to start up a quote-unquote an alternative educational system in Detroit. The idea here was that they would open charter high schools in particular that would provide an alternative to the struggling district. So with Glazer's backing, his influence, and the $800,000 that he steered to the school, they managed to open up. And that brings us to 2014.
And in your story for Chalkbeat Detroit, you say it's very clear this school was in big trouble, wasn't going to make it less than a year after it opened. What was the writing on the wall that that people didn't see?
So first of all, Delta Prep opened right in the middle of an incredibly tumultuous period for Detroit education. It wasn't just the district. Charter schools were opening and closing left and right. Delta Prep was one of a dozen that opened in a short period. So the reality is Detroit had more schools than it needed. And from the very beginning, Delta Prep struggled to enroll enough students. They had projected they would get 200 in the first year. They got just over 50. And that led to a whole series of decisions that pretty much shot the school's chances financially and academically very soon after its very optimistic, sort of bright and shiny start.
And, Kobe, what role is the charter authorizer supposed to play in making sure that charter schools stay open?
So the authorizer is the bottom line, in theory, for charter schools. They're the ones who take a look at the school proposal and say, okay, looks like you all have everything in order to operate. That clears the way for charter schools to receive state funding. And then over the course of the school's life, the best charter authorizers provide oversight and support. So they're checking in regularly at board meetings to see, you know, how are things going at this school? And are there any warning signs of that something could happen like what happened at Delta Prep? In this case, it wasn't enough, obviously.
And this was actually Ferris State was the authorizer, wasn't it?
Right. Ferris State University.
I'm talking with Kobe Levin of Chalkbeat Detroit as we break down just what happened at Detroit Delta Preparatory Academy for Social Justice, a charter school that slammed its doors shut 3 weeks into the school year, basically leaving students and parents high and dry. When you talk to education experts, Kobe, where do they point the finger of blame? Is it a failure of the school, of the charter authorizer, of state policy?
They say that there's plenty of blame to go around. There are individual decisions made by the school leaders that seem to make a bad situation worse. There are really questions for the early backers of the school, you know, who opened a school in a city that had more seats in classrooms than it did students. And I think maybe the most pointed questions they have are for the system as a whole. A system that does not have a centralized way of saying, okay, here is where we need schools. Here are the neighborhoods where students don't have access to the number of seats they need, and let's open schools there. Or a system that says, okay, here are the city's most challenged students, the students who need the most support. Let's make sure that they don't all wind up at one school. There are cities across the country that have lots of charter schools like Detroit does, though perhaps not quite as many, but that takes steps to control, you know, the most severe turmoil caused by a free market education system. And Detroit just doesn't have those.
Well, and in your story for Chalkbeat Detroit, you certainly spent some time addressing the all-out, no-holds-barred, deep-pocketed support of charter schools by the DeVos family. What role did that play?
So there have been efforts to create an oversight system for charter schools in Detroit. This would, at a minimum, provide guidelines for where schools can open and close. That was part of the major piece of legislation that prevented DPS from going into bankruptcy in 2016, but it wound up being killed after a pretty remarkable period of advocacy and philanthropy by Betsy DeVos and her family. The number is $25,000 a day over a seven-week period to legislators who would oppose that plan.
This school, Delta Prep Academy, had big dreams created by, you know, a retired educator backed by prominent black women in Detroit, that social justice focus in a city with major inequities. Kobe, is this an issue of well-intentioned people actually winding up making things worse?
I think that's fair to say. Most of the folks who are involved in this story wound up feeling that the school never should have started in the first place. Edith Fryley, the retired educator you mentioned, told me that when they closed the school, they were calculating that it would hurt the students more to leave the school open than it would to close the school. They thought it was better for students for the school not to exist at that time. So I think this school is a very harsh reality check for the city about the way our current system is working.
And for the students, what has happened for them?
There were about 200 enrolled when the school closed. Most of those have wound up at charter schools that were run by the same management company that ran Delta Prep. A smaller handful have wound up in Detroit's main district. Some went in, out to the suburbs. And there are still 8 to 10 students, as of the last count, who are unaccounted for.
Kobe Levin's piece in Chalkbeat Detroit titled, "If We Don't Learn From This One, Shame on Us, Lessons from a Detroit Charter School That Was Set Up to Fail." Kobe, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
Coming up, a makeover is coming to a Michigan river. It used to catch fire so often that...
I mean, it wasn't even a major, you know, headline event. That's how bad it was.
Cleaning up the old channel on the River Rouge. That's in 10 minutes on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Vegetation Removal Prevention Act, before the lame duck session of the state legislature, would stop cities from prohibiting or restricting removal of trees or other vegetation in non-residential areas. In other words, if a commercial property owner wanted to clear-cut all the trees on that property, the local government could not stop it if this bill passes. Many local governments have ordinances restricting tree removal because of the many benefits to a community. Lee Mueller is a certified arborist with the Davy Resource Group. This company advises cities and companies across the nation on tree management issues. Lester Graham with Stateside and the Environment Report caught up with Mueller in Grand Rapids and asked him why cities pass ordinances to protect certain tree species.
In urban forestry, it's well established in the peer-reviewed literature that trees offer a wide range of benefits. Trees help capture stormwater, they sequester carbon, they improve air quality, and trees actually improve property value. So some communities may look at trees that, whether they're on public or private property, that those trees offer public benefits. Whether, you know, you have a tree on your private property, that tree is going to sequester carbon, it's going to capture stormwater, it's going to improve not only your property value, but also your neighbor's property value. So a number of communities have decided that regulation of those trees and how those trees are removed or retained is important to maintaining not only the community character, but potentially also the community's stormwater management goals, maybe air quality goals, a number of variety of objectives.
Well, I want to get a specific example here. So let's say I've got 10 acres of trees. I want to cut them down so I can have a parking lot there. And it happens to be in a watershed. Well, they're always in a watershed someplace, right? And that slows the rain, right? That canopy might be home to wildlife. That canopy also, depending on where it is in the city, might have some small factor in the heat island effect of a city. Those are all really kind of hard things to quantify. So how does a city enforce that with fines?
Frankly, through the iTree suite of software, they actually can be quantified. Not a lot of communities go that extra effort on a property-by-property basis, and there are also models, so there may be errors. But generally, these ordinances often restrict the removal of trees when it comes, most of them, when it comes to development purposes. So when a land use development or a site permit is pulled for development, that's usually when this kicks in, and it's often to prevent the wholesale clearing of trees. A few communities in Michigan just restrict tree removal regardless of whether or not a permit for land development is pulled. By and large, these are restricted to a certain size of tree and sometimes species classifications of trees. So if you're going to remove a tree over, say, 6 inches or 8 inches in some communities, you may have to either replant or pay a fee to cover what you're not replanting.
Some of these trees are seen as, the bigger trees are seen as historic in some way, and they have greater value. And I'm wondering, how do you determine whether a tree, is it by its size, or in what way do you say this tree is special and it has special protections?
Yeah, again, I think there's a variety of ways these ordinances are written. And some of them simply just say all trees over 8 inches are protected, or all trees over 10 inches are protected. Other ones may add another class for landmark, heritage, or legacy tree, in which they say trees over a certain size are deserving of more protection, or require more replanting, or may require higher fees. Usually that's just determined by what is a so some communities look at it in terms of they have different species with different sizes. Some of them just say all trees over 30 inches. And it's largely recognizing that trees of greater size take longer to grow, take longer to get there, are more fragile, and often actually provide outsized benefits as well. They're usually producing the greatest amount of stormwater capture, the greatest amount of air quality improvement, the greatest amount of property value enhancement. And so they've taken a position that maybe those trees are deserving of greater protection.
Senator Tom Casperson, who's the sponsor of this bill, has said that, look, cities have to back down a little bit because you're infringing on private property rights. Now, you've helped write some of these ordinances. What kind of debate goes on when you are trying to find that balance between community good and private property rights?
Those conversations and decisions are often made by local communities. When I'm asked to help write these ordinances, I'm, you know, a consultant that assists, and I don't make decisions for communities.
Right.
So usually those conversations are balanced by, you know, what have already been decided are community objectives through master land use plans, through urban forest plans, sustainability plans, what have you. And that's usually what frames those ordinances.
So there's well-researched data behind a lot of these ordinances and these decisions.
These ordinances are not outliers. You can find them across Michigan. You can find them across Illinois. You can find them across Ohio. This is a common tool that urban foresters and communities use to influence how trees are treated on private property. Again, primarily during development activities, but sometimes just wholesale as well. Largely connected to a recognition that trees provide a lot of public benefit. And without those trees, communities would face additional fees, for example, in creating stormwater infrastructure. Communities may face lower property values because the aesthetics of their communities change significantly. So these ordinances are not as uncommon as you might think. They can be well-written or they can be poorly written. And it's important when communities look at these ordinances to take into account the balance between the private property rights and what the community goals are and how best to accomplish those.
So, reportedly, the event that prompted this bill was a trucking firm in Canton, which cleared off about 16 acres to make room for more parking space for trucks. How often does something like that happen, and then that developer or that private property owner gets surprised with a fine they did not see coming?
I'm not sure I can. I'm not familiar enough with Canton to really comment.
Well, I mean, any city, though. I mean, how often does that happen in the state?
It's a little outside my area of expertise.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
I'm usually involved in the writing, not necessarily the
enforcement.
Back end.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So if cities lose this ability to restrict this kind of tree removal, what's the worst case scenario?
So we at Davey Resource Group have done a number of urban tree canopy assessments across the country, and in some of these communities, we actually look at trends in tree canopy over time. Invariably, most of these communities see canopy loss. They're losing trees. Even in some of these communities when there's aggressive plans to try to increase tree canopy cover through tree planting, outreach programs, and ordinances, they still tend to lose trees. If communities don't have a full suite of tools available to them to try to encourage tree retention, tree planting, tree preservation, we're looking at a situation where we may be losing tree cover in a lot of our communities, where we may be losing a lot of those benefits such as stormwater management, carbon sequestration, air quality, property values, as trees disappear from those communities.
Lee Mueller is with Davey Resource Group. He's an urban forester. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
To generations of Metro Detroiters, Zug Island has been a sad punchline to stories of industrial pollution, filthy water. And there's good reason for that. Going back to the 1800s, factories used the old channel of the Rouge River around Zug Island as, well, pretty much an industrial toilet. But the old channel will be getting a $50 million cleanup thanks to the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. With us now, Chris Kolaski, director of the EPA's Great Lakes National Program Office, and from that same office, project manager Rose Ellison. Chris, how polluted, just how bad is the water in the Rouge River's old channel, and why is it worthy of this $50 million federal cleanup?
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. Given the number of years that pollution and various contaminants had been discharged into that old channel, it's not clean, and there's a lot of nasty stuff in there. So we are just so delighted to be, you know, looking at the other side of that and looking at this dredging that's going to remove a lot of that and make it much cleaner. We've got a lot of work to do yet, but again, it's just another, in our view, just another shining example of why the GLRI is just being so effective across the Great Lakes.
And when you say the GLRI, that is?
The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Mm-hmm. So since 2010, we've been blessed with funding about $300 million a year on average. The first year we had $475 million, but after that it's been roughly $300 million. And Congress has empowered us and given us a lot of financial firepower to do a lot of cleaning up. And the project here in the old channel around Zug Island is just one very good example of the effectiveness of the program.
What's the price tag on this cleanup?
The total is $50 million, and the dredging we're talking about here is going to be about $16 million. The other thing that I'll point out about that, under GLRI, there's a, I'd call it a sub-program, called the Great Lakes Legacy Act, and under that program, we can do cost-sharing with private entities. And in this case, we're just delighted to be working with Honeywell, who is putting a lot of in-kind sweat equity, if you will, into the cleanup. So they are contributing considerable financial resources to help us get this done. And again, it's just a great way to make things work.
Rose, when you think of the history, industrial history of Zug Island and the old channel, what have been some of the main industries through the decades, and what kind of industrial junk and waste were they dumping into the old channel? How bad did it get?
Well, it got pretty bad for a while, just based on a kind of a snapshot of some data I had from the mid-60s, early 70s. At one time, about 80 to 82 million gallons of untreated industrial waste used to go into the old channel. That's down to no industrial waste at all, and the main discharge is non-contact cooling water from the steel mill. But there used to be a coking facility right on the old channel. There was a chemical facility. There was a paper processing facility, Scott Paper, Detroit Coke, Detroit Tar were all along the old channel. And then the present day or the last residents of the industrial facilities that are there, and Detroit Tar and Detroit Coke are no longer there. But their predecessors were Allied, and prior to that, a company called Solvay Industries. So it goes back many, many years, the industrial history, along over 100 years along the old channel. And then, of course, we have U.S. Steel on the island itself.
And you're saying 80 to 82 million gallons of industrial waste a day going into that channel?
Untreated industrial waste, yep.
Oof.
So these are the days prior to the Clean Water Act, and that was not unusual.
So how do you dredge all that toxic stuff out, containing it at the same time to keep it from spilling out into the rest of the Rouge and into the Detroit River and on out from there?
So we've been working for years on this project and designing it in a way that's going to be protective of the environment while we do it. So we will have what we call silt containment curtains to keep the sediments that get stirred up from going downstream. And one of the unique things that designs, it's called a moon pool, and it's basically just a big square curtain, and the dredging will happen inside that moon pool right off the end of the barge. So the excavator or the bucket will be within this silt curtain, this moon pool, to keep that material from stirring up. And then in addition to that, there'll be other silt curtains as kind of a backup, and we'll be monitoring to make sure that material isn't getting past those silt curtains. And if it does, then we'll have to readjust our operations.
And then once you dredge up all this toxic goo, this stuff, where will it go?
It's going to a confined disposal facility, the U.S. Corps of Engineers confined disposal facility in Point Mulet, which is down near Monroe. It's designed to take dredge spoils. It was specifically designed to take dredge spoils from the Rouge River.
And what contaminants are you most targeting in this cleanup?
The main contaminants are polyaromatic hydrocarbons, PAH. It's kind of an oily goo. Those are the main contaminants. Naphthalene is the main constituent that's of concern, and that which is highly toxic in the environment.
And I know you've been doing sonar scans to get an idea of what you're going to encounter down there in the murky depths of the old channel. What have you found? What's lurking down there?
Well, there's a lot of debris. Over the years, there's old wooden piers from a century ago, wire, construction debris, fill. And, of course, we have a number of cars that we have detected and are going to have to pull up. So there's a lot of material down there, and so the dredging will be slow going because we'll be running into a lot of industrial material.
Chris, can this project serve as a template for other cleanup efforts, this idea that it's a public-private partnership and also kind of targeting an area that has just been a cesspool for so long?
Well, in fact, Cindy, we're doing it all over the Great Lakes. So the Detroit River is one of what's known as an area of concern. Right now, there are still 27 of them on the U.S. side. There are a number of them in Canada as well. So we are spending a lot of resources targeting these areas of concern, again, across the Great Lakes, the Duluth area. There's a batch of them in Michigan. And, you know, the template, yes, we're using that Legacy Act template of private-public partnership wherever we can. But when we look at some of the communities where we've actually finished the work in these areas of concern, the impacts on the economy, on the morale, if you will, of the community, it's just been outstanding because we're taking areas, and when I say we, I just need to be clear that we're talking about many, many partners, federal partners, state partners. There's just so many different entities involved in this. But when you think about it, you know, imagine an old harbor or river town. It's got the kind of pollution you've described. It's been there for a long time. No one wants to go there. You can't fish. And then over a relatively short period of time, you pull out those contaminated sediments. You do some habitat work. Just make it a place that people want to go. And what happens? Well, people go, and then businesses come in because they want to serve those people, and you might have brew pubs or you might have anything. But just the idea of taking these old, contaminated, broken-down areas and turning them into a place that people want to go, seeing that revitalization, it just makes it worthwhile for all of us. And certainly I think it makes it worthwhile for Congress and others. So that kind of a cleanup is just a gift that keeps on giving, and we're delighted to be involved.
Rose, what about the health of the Rouge River overall? How would you rate it?
Well, compared to prior to the Clean Water Act, mm-hmm. you know, it's wonderful. There's still a lot that needs to be done, but over the past, you know, 15 years or so, there's been a huge effort to control the combined sewer overflows in the main part of the Rouge. They've been very successful. Matter of fact, the efforts to control these combined sewer overflows has made projects like this one possible. Otherwise, we'd still continue to have sources. So the water quality in the Rouge, you know, it's an urban industrial river, much better than it was prior to the Clean Water Act in the 70s. One of the major events that spurred on the passing of the Clean Water Act was when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire in the 60s. But when I started working on the Rouge, people that lived there for years used to say the Rouge used to catch on fire all the time. I mean, it wasn't even a major, you know, headline event. That's how bad it was. So anyway, it's much improved. But getting these sediments out is going to really help the overall health of the water body itself.
And I suspect we'll see that in wildlife.
Yeah, and I do want to say that as bad as this area has been, and you used some colorful adjectives earlier about it, there's been these incredible rays of hope there. When we first started looking at this project, we spotted the second beaver in the old channel of the Rouge. It's the second time a beaver had been sighted in 80 years at the time. It was living right where we're going to clean up. And also, sturgeon were found many years ago, spawning right in the Detroit River, right off Zug Island. And those are two seminal species. The conditions aren't ripe for them to stay and thrive, but, you know, there's a lot of interest, wildlife interest in the area, if we can make the area more hospitable to them.
And finally, Chris, when does the dredging actually begin, and when will the project be finished?
We think this project, if everything goes well, and when you're dealing with weather and dredging and being out on the water, certain things can come up, but we're hope to have the dredging capped and restored by, Rose, I believe June of 2020 is the date we're shooting for.
Yeah, early, sometime in 2020 it should be completed.
Chris Kolesky is director of the EPA's Great Lakes National Program Office. Rose Ellison is a project manager at that office as we preview the dredging project that's on the way to clean up the old channel of the Rouge River around Zug Island. Thank you so much for sharing the work with us.
Thank you very much.
Great to be with you.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.